We're beginning here on the bottom of Pechet Amud Bet. The Gemara here is discussing a long situation or story. The story starts back with the mother of Shmuel Ba'aba, Mehagronia, who was married to Rabbi Abba, and she gifted her entire ketubah, her nixei melog, to her son, Rav Shmuel Ba'aba. But then she predeceases her husband, and the question was, who was the entitled party over here? Was it her husband, because she predeceased her husband, and therefore he has the rights to this, or was it her son because she granted it to her son? And since she has the right to do that and give it away to her son, that her son has the preeminent rights here, and therefore he's the one to collect. And there they took their case. Rav Shmuel Ba'aba went to Rabbi Yirmiyah Ba'aba, who favored his side and said that he was entitled to it, the son. And Rabbi Abba went to Rabbi Shaya, who eventually went to Rabbi Huda, who favored Rabbi Abba's position that he was entitled, the husband, or the father was entitled to keep the property. And the Gemara here is going back and forth in the reasoning behind each of their positions. And here the Gemara finally came to a conclusion here, that Amar Rabbi Yossi Bar Chanina, Be'usha Itkino, that in Usha there was a takana, that Isha Shemachra B'Nichsei Melog, a woman who sells Nichsei Melog, B'Chayei Bala, while her husband is still alive, Umeita, and she predeceases her husband, Habal Mutzi Miyad L'Kuchot. The husband has the right then to go take it away from the purchasers or the buyers. So now, we saw in an interim stage here, we saw machloka between Rish Lakish and Rabbi Yochanan about Kinyan Perot. Whether Kinyan Perot aim Kinyan a goof dummy, when you own a leasehold in a property, is that the equivalent of ownership of the property? Or is that simply what you have? You have a leasehold, you don't own the property. Rish Lakish was of the opinion, as Rashi noted in yesterday's daf, that's the way we paskin, and we're going to see that later in today's daf. We paskin like Rish Lakish that kinin peirot lav kikinin aguf dummy. That means now when we're looking at nixei melog, nixei melog are the property that the woman brings into the marriage, which she has the underlying ownership of, and the husband has a leasehold right or production rights on that property. He is entitled to the peirot, the output of that property. So the husband only has what we call kinyan peirot, a leasehold or the production of the property that he's entitled to. The woman has the underlying ownership. And based on Rish Lakish's statement that Kinyan HaPerot Lav Ki Kinyan HaGuf Dami means that the husband's ownership here is not strong enough to prevent the woman from exercising her rights of ownership. That means if the woman sold it, it would be sold. Now she can't sell it while she is still alive or the husband is still alive because of the fact that the land is reserved to the husband for its output rights or for its Perot. But she could sell the underlying ownership. Her husband would continue to benefit from the land while they were alive. And then, depending on the situation, if her husband predeceased her, then in that situation, she is the entitled heir to that property. And she sold those rights, so the other individual will own it, because she had sold those rights to the other individual. In the reverse case, where she predeceases her husband, technically her husband, as the primary inheritor, should be the one who inherits here. But since she had ownership rights and the husband did not have ownership rights, her sale was a good sale. And therefore, the husband then loses that right of inheriting, and the property would go to the person that the woman sold it to. That would be the underlying halacha. In Usha, then, they changed that halacha in one aspect. In terms of if the husband predeceases the wife, then the sale, of course, goes through, because then the woman is the rightful heir to the property, the full rights of the property, and she sold those rights already, and the sale goes through. On the other hand, in the reverse situation where she predeceases her husband, in Usha, that's the takana that we're speaking about here, they were tkinu she'isha she'machara b'nichsei melog. But she sells that property, b'chaye bala, while her husband's still alive, umeita, and she predeceases the bal motzi miyad l'kuchot. He has a lien. They gave him or granted him a lien on the property, a first lien on the property. And that means that even if the buyers, and technically the buyers are fully entitled to this, the husband has first rights here, and he can go and take the property back as the first lien holder on the property. And that's the reason that Rabbi Yehuda believed that Rabbi Abba was entitled to the property and not his son, is because Rabbi Abba is the husband of Rabbi Shmuel Ba'aba's mother. He had the rights to take this property, even though technically the mother had the rights to sell him, and Mi'ikar Halocha, it was that way. But this Takana of Usha prevented that from happening or going through. And as Rashi notes over here, the afagav d'v'alma lav kikinyan aguf dummy, even though normally we paskin like Rish Lakish that it's not a kinyan aguf, ba'al menichse ishto amur rabbanon l'shibudei mishum eva. The Chachamim granted the husband here a super lien on the property, not just a leasehold, not just the production rights, but a super lien, which grants him the right to supersede any lekuchot, any buyers here. And the reason being, mishumeva, so that there shouldn't be any uncomfortable situations, discord between the husband and wife, because the husband sees his wife selling out the property from under him, which basically precludes him from inheriting this property if she predeceases him. And so therefore he becomes the first in line to take the property. And that's the reasoning here. Again, Meikar Halacha, Rav Yirmiyahu ben Abba paskin correctly for Rav Shmuel ben Abba. But because of this takanavusha, that's why Rav Yehuda says that it's not the case and that Rav Yava was entitled to keep the property. Just to note, their Tosavot says, according to Rav Yochanan, who says that kinyan aperot ki kinyan aguf dami, why do you need takanat usha? Because for him, the husband has veto rights because of the fact that he has a kinyan perot, which would prevent the woman from being able to sell it. So Tosavot says, yesh lomar, the itzrich lehecha dekatav la'adin udvarim en libenichseich upeperotayich. The case where the husband suspended his rights in terms of blocking sales or vetoing sales, this takanavusha would still work in his favor, and therefore he could block the sale, or he would have a first right of refusal afterwards to take the property back. Now, Amar Rav Yidi Bar Avin, this is the second to last line on Peichet Amud Bet, Afanan Namitanina. Now, he says, we also find this in a Tanaic work, this takanavusha, Me'idim Anu B'ish Ploni Shigureshet Tishto. If Edim come along and testify the fact that this individual divorced his wife, Benatan Ktubata, and has already paid off her Ktubah, Varehi Tachtav, Umisham Shato, and she is still with him and servicing him, Venimtsu Zomimim. And then we find out that they're Edim Zomimim. As Rashi notes over here, if it's clear that she was divorced by some other set of Edim, then if we find these Edim Zomimim to be lying about the fact that the Ktubah was paid, then it's clear here that the Edim Zomimim would be chayav to pay for the full amount of the ketubah. Because over there, the Edim Zomimim, what they were going to try to cause a loss for her was, she was divorced, we have that evidence from other parties, and now these Edim are coming along and telling us that she's not entitled to her ketubah. We find them to be Edim Zomimim, kashe zamam lasot achiv, that we treat them like what they wanted to do to the other party means that they wanted to cause the woman to lose her ketubah, so they have to pay the ketubah in full. Rashi says that's not the scenario, because we're going to see in 1 second here that the Zomimim are not made to pay the entirety of the Ketubah. Rather, the scenario is a case where these Edim Zomimim, number one, are the Edim that declare to us that she was divorced. And then on top of that, they say that not only was she divorced, but she already got paid her Ketubah. But in truth, she was never divorced, and she's still married to her husband. So these Edim Zomimim, when they're found, what loss did they cause her? Or what loss would they have caused her? So that's what the question is here in terms of what they have to pay. We don't say that they have to pay the entirety of the ketubah. Ela tovat hana'ah ketubata. They only pay for the tovat hana'ah, which means the optionality embedded in the ketubah. Because over here, there is risk involved in the scenario. This woman is not certain to receive her ketubah. There are different outcomes or possibilities as to what would transpire in her marriage. If she is divorced by her husband, or if her husband predeceases her, in those scenarios, she will be entitled to her ketubah. On the other hand, in the reverse situation, where she predeceases her husband, then she will not be entitled to her ketubah. So now we need to assess. These Edim Zomimim who came along and wanted to say she was divorced and she wasn't entitled to her ketubah, how much money did they cause her in terms of a loss? Because she is not certain to get this ketubah in the long run. So if she's not certain to get it, then the fact that they testify that she's not entitled to her ketubah doesn't mean that they caused her an absolute loss. There are risks in whether she would have gotten it, and therefore the loss that they created by saying she doesn't get a ketubah are not the full ketubah, but some discounted value to the optionality. And that's what the Gemara describes over here, which is ezu tovat hana'ah ketubata. What exactly is this optionality that they're going to pay for? Omdim, kama adam rotze liten ketubah shel zo. We figure out how much is someone willing to pay based on the actuarial tables, the circumstances, the situation, and the context. How much are they willing to pay? She'im nit al melau nit garsha. If she is widowed or divorced, that she will receive the ketubah. V'meita, on the other hand, if she predeceases her husband, Yerashena bala, her husband will take the ketubah. So you're buying that optionality of the possible payout of the ketubah in the long run. again, if the marriage ends in divorce, or the marriage ends with her being widowed, in those two scenarios, then she would get the ketubah. And now that she sold it, the parties that bought it from her would get the money. On the other hand, if she predeceases her husband's going to get the ketubah. And if he gets the ketubah, they're going to get nothing. So that is the option that you're trying to price out. How much are you willing to pay today for the possibility of a payout in the long run? Possibility you get nothing. Possibility you get a full payout of the ketubah. You're obviously not going to pay for the full amount of the ketubah. You're going to pay some sort of discounted value that takes into consideration the optionality that's embedded in this possibility of getting the ketubah, which is determined by, again, the actuarial tables of the age of the woman, the age of the man, and their marital status and their marital bliss, whatever else you want to take into consideration, and they'll pay some discounted value. That value, or that discounted value, is what the Edim Zomim have to pay, because that's basically the present value of what the ketubah is worth in the long run, and that present value is what they were going to cause as a loss to her. And that's how we assess what they pay. They don't pay the full amount of the ketubah, but rather this present value. If there is no tekanat usha, amay yirashen abala. Why does the husband inherit her? Then she should be able to sell her ketubah entirely. Because as we noted before tekanat usha, based on Reish Lakish's opinion that kinyan peirot is not kinyan aguf, the woman, no matter the scenario when she sold her ketubah, the lukuchot, the buyers would get it. Whether she predeceased her husband or her husband predeceased her, it would not matter. She had full rights of ownership here and she sold the ketubah. The lukuchot, the buyers would get it irrespective of the outcome. In that case, they would pay for the full value of the ketubah, leaving aside present value about the fact that it's not going to come today, it's going to come in the future. But leaving that aside, she was clearly 100% going to get her ketubah and she could monetize that. Therefore, the Edim Zomim should be chayavim to pay for the entire value of the ketubah. It's only because of takanat usha that there are different possible outcomes, a possibility where they would get paid out and a possibility where they would not get paid out. What you see as evidence from this Mishnah is the fact that there is a takanat usha. That seems to be embedded in the logic of determining the value of the ketubah, that there's this possibility that the husband would get it and supersede the buyers in that case. And that's what he is suggesting over here, the Ravida Ba'avin, that this takanat usha is hinted to or can be seen in this Mishnah. To that, Amar Abaye says back to him, Imam Ruben Ichsei Malog, Yom Ruben Ichsei Tzona Barzel. He says, you are conflating issues over here. There's Nichsei Malog, which is Takanat Usha. Takanat Usha says, in Nichsei Malog, the husband's peirot, or ownership of the peirot, is a blocking mechanism. But over there, you would have had a Havamina otherwise, which is the fact that the woman has a right to sell these items. Now, she still has a right to sell them for the scenarios where she collects the ketubah. She doesn't have a right to sell them in the cases where she produces their husband, and that gives you the optionality. But that is all based on the fact that they are nichsei malog, where the woman has underlying ownership of the property. When you deal with nichsei tzon or barzel, nichsei tzon or barzel are things that the woman brings in as a dowry, and that the husband accepts at their value, and he basically records that in the ketubah, that he owes her that full value. But then at that point in time, the entirety of that value belongs to the husband. And now the husband is encumbered to pay back that money if the scenarios play out where he has to pay out the ketubah. But in that case, nobody believes that the woman has a right of sale over here. The woman's ownership is basically gone from this property. The husband owns it 100%. The gains and losses on the property will belong to the husband, and he is guaranteed to return her the prices which they were brought into the marriage. And there, nobody has a habamina to say that the woman could sell it to these buyers, because the woman has no ownership over here with which to sell. And so you can't say that we're talking about cases of Nixon and Son of Barzel. Even without Takanat Usha, the husband would have a right to block such a sale, because the woman has no rights of sale. And so what Abai says is, the ketubah itself is made up of two parts to it. The ketubah is the core ketubah, plus the dowry on top of that, which is the nichsei tzon and barzel. Those two items are not under the auspices of the woman to sell. The only thing she can sell is the nichsei milog. That's the only thing that she has enough ownership in to sell, and that's what we need a takanat usha for. And that's what Abai says now. All the Mishnah is addressing is the case of nichsei tzon and barzel. In the case of Nixleitz owner Bazel, the woman's sale is clearly blocked irrespective of whether you have Takanat Usha or not, because they're Nixleitz owner Bazel. If the woman's selling something, she's selling rights in the future, not something that she owns, rights in the future that if she collects, she'll give it to them. If the husband collects, she can't give it to them. And the reason the husband, when he collects it, they don't get it, has nothing to do with Takanat Usha. It's the fact that she doesn't have enough ownership to give them away to someone else or sell them to someone else before the husband takes possession of them. And so Abai says, your proof from this Mishnah is just not a proof. The case in that Mishnah is talking about a ketubah or Nixleitz owner Bazel, and that's why the woman doesn't have entitlement to them when she predeceases the husband. It's not because of Takanat Usha, it's a basic because she doesn't own them. Versus the case of Nixleitz Malog, which is what we're speaking about, where she does have ownership, and that ownership, had it not been for Takanat Usha, would have superseded any of the rights of the husband. Amar Abai, Tovatana, Hoyo Va'ata Liyadan, Abai says, well, while we're on the topic of talking about, or speaking about this Tovatana, which means this optionality, which has value today, Name about Milta. Let us say something about it. Let me make a comment halachically about this. Tovatana Liisha Havyo. That when the woman monetizes, say, her ketubah and sells it, and there is Tovatana here, which is the selling of the option, then the money goes or accrues to the woman. Di sakadatcha the baal havyo. If you think it goes to the husband, lemru la edim mafsedinach. Because then they can say to her, what did we cause a loss to you? Irrespective, you're not going to get anything today. Because if you sold it today, there would be no monetary value that would accrue to you. If you monetize it today, your husband will get that money. So now the edim in testifying to her, they're saying, we caused you no immediate loss, or we didn't cause you any loss that could be monetized currently. Yes, we possibly might have caused you loss in the future, but that future will only be determined when the situation happens. And then when that situation happens, everything will be made whole. You'll get your ketubah if you were entitled. You won't get it if you're not entitled. But as far as today is concerned, the monetization would not accrue to her, and therefore we didn't cause you any loss. Iyavat mizabat law, the tovatana, because you sold it for its future optionality, bal havasak shakominech. Your husband would have taken it and collected it. And so therefore, the Eidim Zomimim could claim that they didn't cause her any loss. So, Amar Rav Salman Mishum De'ika Ravach Beita. He says, wait a minute, that's not necessarily true. You're right, the money would not accrue directly to her, but it would accrue to her household as a whole. And that means that her husband, in all likelihood, would be more generous to her. He just got this windfall. He just got this money he wasn't expecting. He was able to monetize something in the future. And then, now that the household has this gain, the woman will be a beneficiary of that gain because the household as a whole is now wealthier or more well-endowed. And so therefore, there is a loss here because that extra money that would have accrued to the household, the woman does feel the loss of that money. Now, technically, if you were really to take this to its ultimate end, you would suggest then that there was a secondary discount that would have to be put on this, which is first the optionality and the money for the chance to collect on the ketubah, that would be paid to the husband. Then you would have to look at that increase in the value of the household, how much of that benefit would accrue to the woman. And that truthfully is the loss that is being caused over here, is that benefit that would have accrued to the woman. Gemara doesn't take that extra step, but simply says that the value of the ketubah that could be sold today based on the future optionality, that is the loss that is caused, and that's the loss that they're going to have to make whole for. And again, that maybe should be paid out to the husband, and then the woman would benefit in the same way. But the loss, even though it wasn't directly to the woman, she does feel the loss, and therefore their testimony is subject to hazama, or the need to pay out in this case, because there was a loss. Amarava, hilchata tovat hana'a li'isha. First of all, the halacha is that tovat hana'a is to the woman, like Abai suggested over here. Ve'ina ba'al ochel perot. And on top of that, the husband is not entitled to the perot. My daima. What's the reason he's not entitled to the perot? Perot takinu le'rabanan. Perot de pera lo takinu le'rabanan. The rabbanan gave him rights to perot. They didn't give him rights to perot de perot. We'll explain what the Gemara means, and then we'll have to try to read it into the words in a second. What the Gemara is saying over here is that generally when a woman gets property while she is still married, in situations where the property belongs to her and her husband doesn't have full entitlement rights to that property, what we say is that they buy property with it, and then the property rights and ownership will remain with the woman, but the output of that property, the leasehold on that property, will belong to the husband. So if the woman somehow inherited property during the time of their marriage that came to her in a way that the husband is not entitled to take full possession of it, that's how we would treat it. So what the Gemara is suggesting over here is that's not the case here. When the woman sells her ketubah forward or tries to monetize her ketubah forward, that money comes to her and solely to her. The husband has no rights of output on it, has no leasehold on that. The money is solely hers. I mean, if we buy property with it, that property would belong to her as an owner, and the output and the leasehold of that property would belong to her as well. The husband had no rights inside of that. Now, the Gemara expresses that by saying that you're entitled to peirot and not to peirot. You're entitled to output of properties that came into the marriage. You're not entitled to derivative profits. So now, the way that the Baal HaTosfot explained it, and the problem with the statement of the Gemara is that we know from the Gemara in Ketubot that if, for instance, the property produces something, and then that production can also be used to buy property, and with that property, then the husband would get peirot. Or in essence, the husband does have rights that if there is additional ownership or value created from this property, husband has rights to that peirot of those derivative profits, because they all stem from the original karka. And in the original karka, the woman has ownership rights, and the husband has leasehold or output rights. And those extend, even if they, for instance, something grew on there that was valuable and they sold it, whatever, it was a tree or something that happened on that property and was sold. Once that tree is sold, the monies from that tree will use to buy more property. The woman would own the property and the husband would get the output of that. So there is peirot. What does what says is, or he differentiates between different types of peirot. He says about peirot de peirot, the ate migufe, anything that comes from the item itself, could go on vlad, vladot, behema, for instance, the babies of the babies of an animal, the behemot melog, pshita, the kinul de rabbanon. There, the husband clearly has rights inside of those animals, man, the babies of the babies, the husband still has rights to those peirot. But our case here is, hainu bemile de atu mi alma. This is that something that's coming from outside. It's not a derivative of the nichse malog in the marriage. It's something or it's property that is coming to them that has nothing to do with the marriage itself or the property of the marriage. And for that reason, the husband has no entitlements here. And that's what the Gemara is saying over here, that there is no, this is a fruit of the ketubah. And the husband doesn't have rights to the fruit of the fruit, meaning he doesn't have rights to the derivative profits of the sale of the ketubah, which is the peirot of the ketubah. When it's talking about nichse malog that are in there, then he has rights to the peirot, and he also has rights to the derivative peirot of the property. That's how Tosafot explains it. He's reading this into the words and saying, yes, that's true that you get peirot and not peirot, but it's limited, or the statement is qualified by the fact that peirot only apply by nichse malog. They don't apply to property that comes from outside the marriage, something that is not a direct connection to whether it was the dowry or the ketubah or the nechassim that were brought into the marriage. Other Rishonim simply express that the husband is not entitled to peirot over here. It's nothing to do with peirot. I mean, the difference between peirot versus peirot, but simply that the husband doesn't have rights of peirot over here. And then they're saying the same thing as the Baal HaTosafot, which is that there's a difference. This is not under those areas of which the Chachamim instituted that the husband has output rights to or leasehold rights to. And so therefore it's not included under the normal takana. And that's being either expressed the way that we have it in our Girsa, which is that he's entitled to peirot, but not peirot, or their Girsa, or many of the Rishonim's Girsa that express it that way, say that it is that you're not entitled to peirot, meaning that you're not entitled to peirot, not in general, but in this situation, this is not included under that takana of peirot. Kiata Rav Papa, Rav Huna b'Rei d'Rav Yeshua mipei Rav. Rav Papa and Rav Huna, when they returned from the Beit Midrash, Amrei Tanina, the takanat usha. We found again the manifestation of the takanat usha in the Mishnah, which is our Mishnah, and this is why this is brought over here. Heved vaisha b'giatan ra'a, hachovel ben chayav, v'hem shechavlu b'acherim turim. We said that altercations with a woman or an Eved Knani are never good or never favor you, because if you damage them, you have to make payment or compensation. But if they damage you, you have no entitlement to payment, you won't get anything. Again, Mishnah continued and said that once they are freed, or once the woman is divorced and they have their own monies with which to pay, then they would be obligated to make the person whole at that point in time. Visa gadatcha, leta le takanat usha. If there is no takanat usha, tizavin nichse malog, vitatein le. Let her sell her nichse malog and pay it out to him. So there is a way for the woman to get independent ownership here of her money, which is that we just said now that if she sells her ktubah, she sells her nichse malog, the value that she gains from that sale belongs to her, not to her husband. So therefore, why do we say over here that the woman has no ownership rights with which to make the injured party whole because she doesn't own anything? The truth is that she does own something, and she owns something that can't be monetized. So why is it that the Mishnah is telling us there's nothing that she owns, you have to wait until later to get paid back? So what they're saying is that's because of Takanat Usha. Takanat Usha makes it that there's uncertainty, and she does not have absolute ownership here in this property. The Gemara asks the obvious question, which is, okay, why does that change anything? Because you can also say, even if the Takanat Usha is in place, that doesn't mean she can't monetize the Ktubah. We just discussed how she can do that. It'll be worth less, but she still can't monetize it. And that's what it says. Lutameh, ni nami di'itala Takanat Usha. Even if another Usha is in place, below mati mizavna legamre, she can't sell it fully. Tizavin and nichse malug, betovat hana. Let her sell it for the optionality that they might collect the Ktubah. Betitele, and then pay him off. Ella, the late law. What must be is that she doesn't have. She doesn't have nichse malog over here. So she can't do that. Hachaname the late law. So therefore, you could say the same thing in your scenario, which is she doesn't have it. So now the Gemara says, you can't prove anything from our Mishnah about Takanat Usha, because no matter which scenario, whether Takanat Usha was in force or not in force, she should be able to monetize something here and pay back the injured parties. The fact that she's not doing that, it means or is indicative of the fact that she doesn't have that ability to do it. Well, if she doesn't have that ability to do it, that would be irrespective of whether we're talking about Takanat Usha or not, because her inability to do it is because she lacks nichse malog. Had she had nichse malog, she could have monetized it either fully without Takanat Usha or monetized it for its optionality with Takanat Usha, but that she still have an ability to pay. And that tells you that the Mishnah is talking about a case where there are no nichse malog. If there are no nichse malog, that there's nothing to discuss in our Mishnah as a proof to whether there is or is not a Takanat Usha. So Gemara says, oh, while we're on this path, well, this seems like a good reasoning. And then why don't we say that, Ella, let us suggest over here that let her sell Tizabin Ktubata B'Tuvatana V'Titainle. Let her sell her Ktubah. Forget about Nechse Belog. Let her sell her Tzoner Barzel. Tzoner Barzel clearly have optionality embedded in them. Tzoner Barzel are this binary option, which is either she is going to be divorced or widowed and she will collect the money, or she will predecease her husband and she will get zero. That is a binary option, meaning that the two possibilities, you get zero, you get it all. Then you'll have to price the chances and the probabilities of those two outcomes. And then Bezer, it's really three outcomes, but two real scenarios that she gets paid out. And in that optionality, somebody will pay money for it today. So why don't we force her to monetize her Ktubah today and pay back these injured parties? Forget about Nechse Malog. Let her do it Nechse Tzoner Barzel at a discounted rate to the value of her Ktubah. Gemara says, Hamani Rabbi Meir he. The author of the Mishnah is Rabbi Meir. Damar asur lo la'adam shishayet ishto afilu sha'achat below Ktubah. Meir says, you're not allowed to be married. You're not allowed to keep your wife without a Ktubah. V'tai mamai. What is the reasoning that you must have a ktubah in place in order to be married? Because kedei shelotei kala beinav lahutzia, in order that it won't be easy for him to divorce her. Hacha lo megarishla, di megarishla, anu hanach dezabne v'gavulak ktubata mine. So the Gemara says, I don't think that the logic here stands up. You're telling me that the reason that in the Mishnah we don't demand of her to monetize her ktubah is because it's authored by Rabbi Meir. And Rabbi Meir believes you need to have a ktubah in order to be married. And now that she sold her ktubah, she doesn't have a ktubah anymore. So how can you be married without a ktubah? Gemara says, wait a minute. What's the underlying reason behind Rabbi Meir's shita that you must have a ktubah? The ktubah is a way to create a glue in the marriage. It's a way to create a disincentive for divorce or an incentive to work out problems so that you don't get divorced. Because otherwise you're going to have to pay out the ktubah. And that'll be a big monetary burden on the husband. So it's a disincentive for divorce. And that's where Rabbi Meir says you must have a ktubah in place, because you must have that disincentive in place, or you must have that incentive in place to continue the marriage and try to work on rectifying the marriage. So what the Gemara suggested is, if she sold her ketubah, that disincentive is gone. Gemara says, that's just not true. The question is, who's the recipient of the money? But the husband's going to have to pay out either way. If she sells the ketubah, and he divorces her, he will still have to pay her the amount of the ketubah. It just won't go to her, it'll go to the buyers. But in either way, he's going to be out the money. So the disincentive exists in either scenario. Whether she didn't sell the ketubah and he's divorcing her, and he's going to have to pay the ketubah to her. If she did sell it and he's divorcing her, he's still going to have to pay out the ketubah. It just won't go to her. It'll accrue to the buyers. So that disincentive is still in place. And so why don't we demand of her to monetize the ketubah? So Ella tovatana mile ninhu. Umile lo mishtabde. He says, no, tovatana is just a promise of the future. And since it's a promise of the future, you can't create a lien on it. Here, the Gemara indicates something, which is the fact that in the injury caused by this woman, the nizak, the injured party, has a lien. That we've seen before, that injured parties have a lien on the mazik, on the mazik's property, on the mazik's possessions. They have a lien by which to collect. And they have a precedent lien. Remember, we saw that before, that they get from Meitav, they get Idit. They're the first in line in terms of collection, and that there are rights of collection. But that can only work if their lien is exercised on something that exists. If it's something that doesn't exist, then their lien doesn't come about, or they don't really have a lien over here. That's what the Gemara says over here, that the ketubah is just a future value, and since it's a future value, they don't have any lien. If they don't have any lien, then we can't demand of the woman to sell it and monetize it. Gemara says, alam alam. What are you talking about? It's not just a future promise. Mile de mizavne bidinari indinhu. That this is a future promise that has monetary value today. Someone will purchase the option today and give you money. So it's not that he has a shibud on the something in the future, some sort of future value or payout. This is something that could be monetized today, could be sold on the market today. And that means it has real value today. If you have something that has real value today, then the nizak has a lien on that real value. And it's not simply mile, it's mile that has real value. And if it's mile that has real value, he could have a lien on it. So again, we're back to the original question. Why don't we force the woman to monetize her ketubah and pay back the injured parties here? The Gemara says, the reason is, Hela mishum Shmuel. The reason we don't do it is because of Shmuel. Damar Shmuel, al mecher shtar chov lechavero, v'chazaru mechalo, Machul, Bafilo Yoresh Mochel. This is a principle that we've seen other places in Shas. It's a very important principle and has major implications in terms of loans and the ability to sell loans. What the Gemara says here is that even after a person has sold the rights to a loan, if they are a creditor and they sell the rights of collection to another party, they can still forgive the loan. The original owner, the original extender of the credit, can forgive the loan. And that means that you're never certain when you buy the loan whether you're really going to get it. Because when you get it and when you purchase it, there's still this risk that the original owner will go back and be mochel, will forgive the loan, and then you won't be able to collect anything. And not only is it true that he can do it, even a yoresh, even his inheritor, who then takes over the creditor rights, he can also be mochelet. If he forgives the loan, then the buying party is out of luck and they get nothing. So here too, and we're going to explain one second what the logic behind that is. But here, too, you have the same problem, which is that the woman is selling her ketubah forward. Now, the ketubah is an obligation of the husband towards the wife. In essence, she is a creditor that has rights of collection from her husband. So now she sells those rights to someone else to collect the ketubah instead of her. Then she, after she sold them, says, you know what? I love you so much, my husband. I'm going to forgive you. I'm going to tell you, you don't have to pay me my ketubah. Once she does that, the rights that she sold are worthless. If the rights she sold are worthless, then how are we going to have her sell out this tova tana for this poor buyer who's going to end up with nothing? Well, the reason behind the ability to be mochel and alone, there are two major streams in the Rishonim as to how to understand this. There is the Rabbeinu Tam. The Balei Tosafot bring this Rabbeinu Tam in many places in Shas, who bifurcates the din of a loan. When a person extends credit to a debtor, in extending credit to the debtor then has two responsibilities to him. The repayment of the loan is his primary responsibility. But how he makes that repayment of the loan, he first of all encumbers all of his property to the creditor. And that's how the creditor will have rights then if he defaults on the loan to co-collect from his property. But beyond that, he also is mishabed himself. He is encumbering himself or basically making a promise that he will repay the loan. He's making a commitment, a shibud aguf, as it's called, for him to pay it back. Now, it's not so much of a shibud aguf that in the end the creditor can go and then sell this individual and force him to pay back the loans, but there is this shibud aguf, which is the promise of the debtor to the creditor. And then when the creditor sells the outstanding collection rights, the only thing they can sell is the encumbrance that exists on the property, in the rights of collection and the rights to go after the property of the debtor. What they don't sell and what still exists is the shibud aguf, which is the promise by the debtor to make payment, pay back the loan or the credit that was extended to them. That shibud aguf still exists. And so what ends up happening is that he sells one part. The other part remains with him, the original creditor. And then when the creditor forgives the loan, he's forgiving that shibud aguf. That shibud aguf is the demand, or basically the promise of the debtor to make the payment. Once he forgives that, then there's nothing left in terms of repayment. The encumbrance on the property is only a derivative to the promise that he will pay it back. If he doesn't have to make whole on that promise, then his property being encumbered has no meaning anymore. So that's the way the Rabbeinu Tam explains it. Tosfot brings it many places in Shas, that's the reason behind the Rabbeinu Tam. The Rambam has a similar idea. The other Rishonim, the Balei Tosfot themselves, bring another shita, not the Rabbeinu Tam, but the shita of the Balei Tosfot, which is a belief that the ability to sell a loan is only a din derabanan. The midoraita, the loan is never sold. It's basically a institution derabanan that you would be able to sell the loan. So since the loan is only sold midorabanan, the minatorah, the loan still exists between the debtor and the creditor. If the creditor forgives it, midoraita, the loan is gone. Because the sale was only a, we call it a fiction derabanan, and therefore it cannot override the fact that midoraita, the loan still exists with the original parties. So therefore, if they forgive it, then the forgiveness, it's a serious issue. Something that happens in the market today, which is a major part of the liquidity in the market, the ability to sell loans or rights of collection to different parties, collection agencies, to consolidate mortgages, all these things. The banks sell them all the time. So here the Gemara doesn't have a recognition of the ability to do that because the original owner can forgive it. Tosfot over here speaks about a possibility of getting around that, which is b'mamad shloshtam. That if you do it b'mamad shloshtam, then you can finalize such a sale. You're allowed to sell those collection rights. So Tosfot asks your question, which is, wait, the market does have the existence of a mechanism to sell loan. That mechanism is mamad shloshtam, which is a situation in which all three parties are there. Again, it's a din derabanan that was put in place to allow for ease of commerce, which is called mamad shloshtam. That could be utilized here in order to sell the loan. Well, if that's the case, then we don't have a problem because then you can't back out of it. Tosfot says, why doesn't the Gemara ask that? Why doesn't the Gemara use that mechanism? And he says that that mechanism only works where you have a right today to collect. It doesn't work for future rights of collection. The Ketubah, it has no right of collection today. Right of collection is all based on the future and based on future events. So he says, mamad shloshtam only works for something that's in the present, not something that's in the future. And so for that reason, he says that even though mamad shloshtam might work to allow or facilitate the sale of loans, it won't work for the sale of the ketubah or the ability to monetize the ketubah forward because mamad shloshtam would not overcome the problem that this is a future event and not a present ability to collect. All right, so now the Gemara says, well, Amrei zvunei zavin v'titen le, let her sell the ketubah forward and give it to him. V'machla le legabe bal timchalom. And if she forgives it, she forgives it. But if she doesn't forgive it, then the buyer doesn't lose out. Where it says, Amrei, kol legabe bal vade machla le. V'afsedine lahauzvina biyadayim lo asvedinu. Where it says that it's a given. It's an anan sade, basically, or an umdina didat, that the woman will forgive the ketubah, the gabe, her husband. Once she's sold the ketubah out, then she will automatically, or by definition, forgive it. It's one thing if she sold the ketubah voluntarily. And then we could say, maybe she will, maybe she won't forgive the ketubah. But in a situation or scenario where she's compelled to sell the ketubah, she had no vested interest in selling her ketubah, and therefore she will work to basically undermine what we've done or get her husband off the hook. And so she definitely, we can assume that she will forgive this, or it's as if she's already forgiven the requirement of the husband to pay it. So therefore, we are not going to allow a guy to go buy it knowing that he's going to lose his money. Once he makes the purchase, there's just no way that he's going to end up with the money because she's definitely going to forgive him. So that we wouldn't institute. Where it says, V'chite ma zvina nihale lahu dechavla betovatana. Let her sell the ketubah to the person she injured. Instead of selling it to a third party, monetizing it, and then giving him the proceeds, let her sell it directly to the individual whom she injured. De'i machla legabe bao lo ka mafsid. Because even if she forgives it, he's no worse off than he was before. He before was getting nothing. Now he's getting nothing. At least if we have her sell the ketubah to him for that value, there's a possibility that he's actually getting something now. So why not at least put that into place so that there's a possibility he gets something? If she forgives it, he gets nothing. If we didn't institute this, he would have gotten nothing either. So there is a lost in. Gemara says, so. Called the Gabi Baal Vade Machla. He says, forget it. Because by definition, when she does this scenario or creates this scenario, she's going to forgive it. So then it's going to be that he gets nothing. Okay, so he gets nothing. He wasn't getting anything before anyway. So why not just do it? The Gemara says, Vachuche Beidina Bichti Lo Matrachinan. We're not going to waste Beit Din's time to put this all in place just to have it become a zero. That doesn't make sense. It's not worth Beit Din's time to put this together and then have her just forgive the loan afterwards, which is going to happen anyway. Yes, there's no loss to the person, but in the end, there's no gain either. If there's no gain, why bother Beit Din to go through all of these machinations to get nowhere? Now, Tosfot says that the Gemara's statement here that he loses nothing is not really true. Because in this scenario where he doesn't get paid today, he gets zero today, but he gets 100% in the future. Because whenever she collects her ketubah, or whenever she gets the money in the future, he will get paid. On the other hand, if he takes the ketubah or the monetized ketubah as payment, and then she forgives the loan, he's going to get nothing in the future because there will never be a ketubah paid to this woman. There's no ketubah paid to this woman. He's going to collect zero. So he's actually got himself in a worse position when he takes collection on the ketubah. So that's what it says. Why doesn't the Gemara make that distinction? He says, V'yesh lamar, kevin d'achshav lo eita notenet lo klum. Since right now he would have gotten zero. Afilu lo machla. Even if she didn't forgive it, the fact that now she forgives it isn't such a big loss. He was getting zero today. In the future, there was still a risk he would get nothing as well, depending on whether she predeceased her husband or not. So there were possibilities of getting zero. So that's what Tosfot says. Overall, it looks like a zero this way, and it looks like a zero that way. It's not such a big deal. So that's why he says they're considered to be even outcomes, even though in the case where he doesn't accept the sold ketubah, he has a higher likelihood that he would get paid out or get paid out in full in the future. There's still first of all a risk that he's getting nothing today. Number two is a risk that she won't collect the ketubah because she'll predecease her husband, and he would have gotten nothing in the future. So that's what the Gemara is just broad strokes of saying, look, it's not worth much this way, it's not worth much that way, so why not at least try it? The Gemara in the end rejects it and says it's worth so little, because almost definitely she's forgiving it, or it's a given that she's forgiving it, and therefore why go through all this, because he's getting nothing anyway. But the Gemara from this shows why we do not compel the woman to sell her ketubah in order to make payment on the nezek. So Gemara says, Alaha d'tanya, but what about this break? If she injures her husband, she doesn't lose her ketubah. Am I? Why not? Tizavina nihale the ketubata. Let's compel her to sell her ketubah back to her husband in order to monetize it currently. Basically, we're asking the husband, how much would you pay today for the possibility of not having to pay the ketubah in the future? The husband's obligated to make that payment in the future under certain circumstances. Are there other circumstances he won't pay? How much is the husband willing to pay today to undo that liability in the future? So that should be the money. If that's the case, then that money should be monetized today. And that should be her payment to the husband. Because if she does it, Because in the end, if now she forgives the outstanding debt, she's forgiving the husband himself. He's a beneficiary of the forgiveness as well. So that he doesn't end up losing anything. If she forgives it, he gets the beneficiary. She doesn't forgive it, he's also the beneficiary. So let the husband buy it off of her in that scenario. Mar says, Havade Rabbi Meir. That brighta for sure is author Rabbi Meir. Damar asur la'adam shisha et ishto afilu sha'achat velo ktuba. Because we don't want a woman staying together with her husband even for a short period of time without a ktuba. Mar again says, v'taim amai. What's the reasoning? Kadei shlo te'kala be'inav lehotziah. Because she won't be easy to divorce. Mar says, v'acha megarish la begavi lei b'chavlei mina. The Gemara says, well, over here, he's going to divorce her, and then he can collect his chavalah. Over here, there's no reason for him not to divorce her, because if he divorces her, he'll collect on the damages that she did to him, the injury that she caused him. The Gemara says, forget about her selling the ketubah to her husband. Even without the sale to her husband, why can't the husband take that option right now and divorce her and collect his chavala? I mean, that what you're saying is that the ketubah is a disincentive to divorce. And over here, he wants to divorce her because when he divorces her, he's going to collect his chavala. And so you've taken away the disincentive here because he's now bought his ketubah back. He's going to owe no money. If he owes no money, then it's worth it for he could divorce her and he'll collect his money and it'd be done. So the Gemara says, wait, that scenario or that logic exists independent of whether she sells the ketubah to her husband. Even in a regular scenario, the husband could divorce her. If he divorces her and pays out the ketubah, he'll get his money back. What's the problem with that? The Gemara explains now, this doesn't make so much sense, Gagon, the nafish ketubah ta, because her ketubah is worth more. The mishum ha'uporta lo mafsi tuva. It does not pay for him to divorce her in that scenario, because the payout of the ketubah far exceeds the return he's going to get for the injury. So why would he force a divorce today in order to collect his payments for the injury, when by forcing the divorce today, he's also going to have to pay out the ketubah today? That's the scenario, then he's not going to divorce her now to collect, because it's not in his vested interest to do that. On the other hand, if they do sell the ketubah to the husband, then that disincentive is gone. Because in that scenario, if he divorces her, he's not going to have to pay out anything, because he is now the owner of the ketubah. The Gemara says, okay, Eden fisha ketubata miktubah deoraita, if her ketubah is worth more than a ketubah deoraita, ketubah deoraita doesn't necessarily mean a ketubah midoraita, that's a machloket in the Vishonim, in other places in Shas, as to whether ketubah is derabanan or deoraita. What the Gemara is saying here by ketubah deoraita means that the core ketubah that is entitled, whether it means min the Torah or the rabbanan's institution of ketubah, what she's entitled to. So if her ketubah exceeds that value, nukma ketubah deoraita, v'idach tezavna ni'ale b'chavle. So let us do this. Rabbi Meir agrees that if you have a core ketubah, that's enough of a disincentive to get divorced. You don't need a very large ketubah in order to prevent divorce. So let's say that her ketubah is worth in excess of what the minimum ketubah is, mid'oraita, mid'rabbanan. Minimum ketubah for an almanah is 100, and the minimum ketubah for a betulah is 200. So say she has a ketubah that's worth 400. So let us leave her the 200 that she's entitled to of a core ketubah that every woman is entitled to. And the excess 200, let's force her to monetize that. Because in that case, the ketubah still exists. The core ketubah still exists. The disincentive still exists. But she's able to monetize the excess amount. Where it says, "Kigon to no fisha ktubata miktubah doraita," that must be the case here. It's a case where her ktubah is the core ktubah. It does not exceed the core ktubah amount, and therefore the husband over here is not going to divorce her if the ktubah is still intact, because dahave chavlei arba azuze, his injury that he's going to collect for is 4 zuz. To mishum arba zuze lo mafsi esrim v'chamisha. And here's a question. Here you can see in the Tosfot whether it's esrim v'chamisha zuze or esrim v'chamisha. Would he give up for 25 zuz to collect 4 zuz? That is because the 25 zuz, if you say that the word zuz appears here, that's Rashi's claim that a zuz is what is the gears over here, and 25 zuz, each zuz is worth 4 dinarim, and then he turns out that you have 100 dinar, which is the minimum ketubah of a almanah. That's what the Gemara is saying. In order to collect 4 zuz, you're going to trigger a obligation to pay 25 zuz? Doesn't make any sense. On the other hand, the Baal Tosfot bring an alternate. It's not 25 zuz, but 25. And we're talking about here is 25 selat suri. Sela Tzuri is twice as much as the Sela Medina, which means that it'll turn out to be 200 dinar, or basically your basic tuba of a tula. So why would he, in order to collect his 4 zuz of injury, why is he going to trigger his necessity to pay a much larger sum of money? It doesn't make sense. He's better off waiting to collect on the chavalah and not having to pay out the ktuba immediately. And so therefore the disincentive for divorce exists in a normal case where the ktuba has not been sold, because he won't do it, he won't trigger that in order to get his payment back. And so now the Gemara continues and says, Elahad Tanya, that which is written in the Braita, Kishem Shalotim Kor Vihi Tachtav, Kach Lotav Seed Vihi Tachtav. That just like she can't sell it while she's still under the auspices of the Baal, so too she can't lose it while she's under the auspices of the Baal. V'hazimnin d'mishkachla d'mifsida. Wait a minute, there are times where she does lose her ktuba. V'echidami, what's the case? Like you just explained now, when her ktuba exceeds the case, the core ktuba, we would tell her to monetize the excess amount and pay back her husband. Because again there, if she forgives that excess amount, then the husband's not a loser, the husband's the winner in that scenario, because he's the one who owns it. So in that scenario, we would force her to monetize it with regards to the husband. So why are you saying over here in this braita, Kishem shelo timkor v'tachtav, that she's not allowed to sell it out to a third party, so too, she doesn't lose it with regards to her husband. We don't force her to sell it to her husband in order to lose that portion of the ktuba. That's not true. There is a difference in the din between outside parties, third parties, and the husband. In a case where ktuba exceeds her core ktuba, that excess amount, if she was to monetize it to a third party, that would be a loss to the person who buys it from her, because she could forgive it to her husband. But in the case where it's her husband and she sells it to the husband, then there's no loss from the fact that she forgives it. Therefore, we would force a situation like that for her to pay. So the cases are not equivalent. In that an injury done to a third party is not the same as an injury done to the husband. The case of an injury done to the husband, we might force a monetization of the excess of the ktuba above its core amount, because we don't have the risk of her forgiving the loan there. And that's why Rashi explains it over here. Rashi says, if you look, kasakadatka ochi kamar, kashem sheena yecholalim kor bodatachtav, just like she can't sell what she's under him. Kach lo tafsid miktubata klum, shvo shum, chavalav and nezek shemazik bodatachtav. The way that we read it, Rashi explains over here that the woman will lose nothing in this scenario, whether it's she injured a third party or whether she injured her husband, and that's what the Gemara is challenged by based on their understanding now. Balei HaTosafot actually read it slightly differently and says, Vein Nira L'ri, what Rashi says, Menira L'ri, Kashem Shalot Timkor Bishvil Chavala Bacharim Bodo Tachtav, Kloma Lo Timkor Ktubata Lebala Bishvil Chavala Bo. The Ri changes what Rashi's Havamin is, because he says we do see that the woman is entitled to sell the Ktubah B'Tovata Na'ah. That's not something that she's prevented from doing. What we're saying here is, or what the Havamin and the Breita is, that just like we won't compel her to pay for the Chavala to a third party, we also will not compel her to pay for the chavala through the monetization of the ktuba to her husband. So he narrows the scope of what the havamina is over here. The Gemara is now going to have to deal with that, because it's irreconcilable how we're explaining the situation now. The Gemara says, Amarova Seifa, this part of the Braita, what we just quoted over here, it's called the Seifa, because it's the continuation of the Braita that we brought above. Atan l'ktubat benin dichrin. That has to do with ktubat benin dichrin. Ktubat benin dichrin, where the ktubat of male children is, that the fear in a society that is not monogamous, meaning that you have a man with multiple wives, and now you have a father-in-law who's granting property to his daughter, with a risk that this husband is going to inherit that property from his daughter, and then give it out to children that don't belong to him, that are not his own grandchildren. They are children from another wife. And no father is going to be generous in giving a dowry with the risk that that money will then go or accrue to the benefit of parties that he has no blood relationship to, no familial relationship to. For that reason, the Chachamim established something called Ktubat Benin Dichrin, which is that whatever is embedded in the ktuba of the woman, when it comes to the division of the estate, the children will divide up the estate as long as there's sufficient money to exceed both ktubot. They will first divide up the estate based on the value of the ktubot. So that means if woman A has a ktubah worth 1,000 and woman B has a ktubah worth 200 and the estate is worth 1,400, the first 1,000 will go to the children of the woman with the ktubah worth 1,000. The children of the woman with a ktubah for 200 will collect 200. The excess 200 above that amount will be split evenly between them, and they'll each get 100 of that. But that is a ktubat b'din dichlin, because then the father will give generously, because he knows that that property will end up with his grandchildren, his blood relatives, and not all the children of this husband. So now what Rava is suggesting over here is, this ktubat b'din dichlin is what we're saying here. Just like when she sells her ktubat, they don't lose the ktubat b'din dichlin, so too, when she sells it to her husband, they don't lose the ktubat b'din dichlin. V'hachitani. Just like when she sells her ktubah out to third parties, the ktubat b'din dichrin, or this clause that is put in the ktubah, is not nullified. She only sold her ktubah because she was under monetary duress, and she needed to raise money, so she sold it because of that. But because she sold it under duress, or to gain money in this situation, we don't assume that she really wants to nullify the ktubah, or, in essence, lose the rights that are embedded in the ktubah. Kach, mocheret ktubata lebala, lo ifsida ktubat benin dechrin. So too, if she sells it to her husband, she also doesn't lose her ktubat benin dechrin. My time, zuzeu dantzua. It was her need for cash that did this, or she was compelled to sell it in order to monetize it, but not because necessarily she was really wanting to do it, or wanting to lose this money. And so therefore, we leave intact the remainder of the clauses of the ktubah. It's the way that contracts are written today. The way the contracts are written today is that there's always like a phrase somewhere near the end of the contract that says that if any part of this contract is null or void, or considered to be illegal, it does not change the rights that are asserted by the remainder of the contract. That's the same thing over here. She sold her ktubah. But when she sold her ktubah, she simply sold it for the monetary rights that she has over here. What she didn't give up are other rights that are granted in the ktubah, including the right of her children to gain or to be the ones who inherit. Now, the scenarios are different. In the case where the payout will happen is a case where the father predeceases the wife, and then the wife will collect the ktubah. In that scenario where she collects the ktubah, it'll be paid out to these buyers. In the scenario where she predeceases the husband, then in that scenario, the buyers get nothing. They won't collect here at all. But what we're suggesting is the fact that she sold the ktubah means that maybe she waived her rights in the ktubah completely. What Rava is coming along to tell us is no, those rights still exist. So even though she has now predeceased her husband, and the husband is the inheritor here in the lekuchot, the buyers are out, but the fact that she demonstrated her willingness to sell the ktubah, maybe she lost her rights as ktubah b'din dichrin. That's what the bright is coming to tell us. No, she didn't. Even if whether she sold it to a third party, or whether she sold it to her husband himself, in either of those cases, she did not waive her rights to getting the ktubah b'din dichrin. And therefore, she predeceases her husband, the ktubah b'din dichrin will still be in force. Yeah, basically it says that the right to sell the ktubah does not waive her rights to any other privileges that she has through the ktubah. So Gemara says, Lema takanatusha tanayehi. Let us suggest that the takanavusha is actually a machloket tanaim. The tani chada, avde melug, yutzim b'shein v'ayin lisha, avalodi ish. Avde melug are eved knani that are nichse melug. Again, they're owned by the woman, but their output or their production is owned by the husband because they're nichse melug. We also know that in eved knani, if a tooth or an eye is knocked out, they go free. But that's only true if the owner of the Eved Kanani knocks out the tooth or the eye. So you have one braita that says that with regards to a shein v'ayin knocked out, if the woman knocks it out, they go free. If the husband knocks it out, they do not go free. V'tani idach, we have another braita that says, lo ish v'lo isha. Doesn't matter who knocks it out. Doesn't matter if the woman or the man knocks out the eye or the tooth. Excuse me, the Eved Kanani is not entitled to go free. So Gemara suggests over here, savrua, we thought to say, the kulyama kinyan peirot, lav ki kinyan aguf dami. Just like we paskin before, like Reish Lakish, here the Gemara is making this statement. It could have gone the other way, but it's explaining it the way that Reish Lakish does, because that is the halacha. The kinyan peirot is lav ki kinyan aguf dami. My lav, b'haka mifligit. This is their machloket. The manda marli shah, late takanatusha. The one who says that if the woman knocks out the tooth or the eye, the eved goes free, is because he doesn't have takanatusha.
That means that the ownership of the property solely and fully belongs to the woman. And since it solely and fully belongs to the woman, and the husband has no rights of blocking here, I mean that she can sell her nixei malog, then in that scenario, if she knocks out the shein and the ayin of the Eved Knani, she's the owner, and the Eved cannot even go free. On the other hand, the other Braita holds or has the Takanat Usha. And since it has the Takanat Usha, that means that the husband is granted super rights or ownership here inside of this Eved Kenani. That means that their rights take away from the other party's rights, meaning that her rights of ownership are blocked by the husband's rights. The husband's rights are blocked by her, but that means that neither of them are full owners of the property. And for that reason, it doesn't matter if the husband or the wife knocks out the I or the Shane of the Eved Kenani. The Eved Kenani will not go free because neither of them own the Eved Kenani in a full enough way to be considered the owners of the Eved Kenani. So that's the Gemara's suggestion, is to explain the difference in the Braito. Basically, they're arguing about this Takanat Usha. So that's what Gemara says. Gemara says, no. The Kuliyama itluhu Takanat Usha. Everybody has Takanat Usha. Elikadam called him Takana, Kanachar Takana. The first Braito is talking about before the Takanat Usha, where the woman had all the rights of ownership. And the latter Braito is talking about the case post the Takana, where the husband has enhanced rights of ownership, and that's why neither of them are considered the owner. Ibaitema. And then some suggest, Idi v'idi lachar Takana. It's all after the Takanat. V'idle Takanat Usha. And everybody holds of Takanat Usha. Elamanda amar li isha v'lo li ish maitaima. The one who says it's the for the woman can free him and not the man for injuring him is maitaima kidirova. Because of Rava, the Amar Rava, Hekdesh, Chametz, Vishichrur, Mafkin, Midei, Shibud. That these three items can free an individual from a Shibud. Meaning that, and this is an important concept, which is that if you have a lien on a property, that lien can be undermined by these three things. Hekdesh, Chametz, and Shichrur. We're going to go through each one of them. Say, for instance, the simple way to explain with Hekdesh is you have a case where you have a shor. You have an animal that was set aside as collateral for a loan. It was an aputuki. Now, if the owner of this animal, meaning the debtor here, who has pledged this animal as collateral for the loan, goes ahead and is makdish the animal to go on the mizbeach, then hekdesh wipes out the lien that was there from the creditor. And now it belongs to hekdesh, and it's going to go on the mizbeach, and the owner can bring it on the mizbeach without any problem. It's not even considered stealing. And the creditor is at a loss. His shibud was ruined by the ability to be makdish. Now Rashi qualifies this and says it's only a case where it's hekdesh aguf. When you're makdish, the goof an animal to go on the mizbeach, that's the only time that is true. But on the other hand, if you're makdish it for damim, if you're simply makdish it for its monetary value, in that case, the creditor does not lose out. That the Gemara and Kedushin told us that you redeem the animal. But pijon, you can redeem the animal. Since you can redeem the animal with a small amount of money, the creditor just does that small redemption, pays like a pruta to Hekdesh, so that people don't say that it goes free from Hekdesh without any payment, and then he can collect out of the animal. So that type of Hekdesh is not protective. It's only Hekdesh aguf that is protective. Rashi says that here. Balei Tosafot also say it over here, but the Balei Tosafot, not here, but in other places, Shatz bring a Rabbeinu Tam who disagrees and says that it applies both to Hekdesh aguf and Hekdesh damim. Now, the reasoning behind that, the Balei Tosafot explain over here, is because Hekdesh Aguf is something where the owner's rights have been basically suspended and given over to Hekdesh. Even though we saw before early in the Masech that the name of the owner is still associated with the animal, but in all intents and purposes, the owner of the animal now is Hekdesh. On the other hand, when it comes to Hekdesh Damim, when a person grants it to Hekdesh for its monetary value, over there, the owner has a right of redemption. The owner's right of redemption means, or in other words, indicates that the ownership of Hekdesh is not so strong here. Because since the owner can exercise rights of redemption, so too the creditor can exercise those rights of redemption and then reassert his lien. And then the Balei Tosafot say that the same reasoning applies by Chametz and Shichrur, which is that whatever entitlement that the Balim have, then the creditor can take that entitlement. If the Balim don't have entitlement, then the creditor doesn't have entitlement. So over here, once you've freed a slave, you can't take back that freedom. Once it's been awarded to the slave, it can't be reversed. And same thing with Chametz. The Torah says that once the Chametz is in the possession of this individual, then the Chametz becomes a sur. And therefore that isur wipes out the owner's relationship to the item. So it also wipes out the creditor's relationship to the item. And so for that reason, all of these items where the Baalim in a sense, lose their ownership over the item. So too, the creditor loses his right or ownership over the item. And this is the way Tosafot phrases it. Kevin sheyesh li isur koach lachol sha'a achat. Since the isur can take effect for a moment, whether that means hekdesh, whether that means chametz, or whether that means the freedom of the slave, as long as it takes place and it takes hold for a moment, it cannot be reversed. It cannot be backed out of. And since it can't be backed out of, then the owner lost rights, and so did the creditor lose his lien on these items. So now, beyond that, Rashi says it over here, Tosfot extends it even further. Rashi says over here that hekdesh doesn't necessarily mean literally hekdesh. It means anything that results in the item being exclusively designated for this particular usage. And the example Rashi gives is, by kedusha the guf, the same tachriche amet, kedushua the guf dami. The tachrichim of a mate have the same din as kedusha the guf, umafkia v'desrim ba'ana'a. They become asur ba'ana'a, and they're mafkia midei shibud. So here is something where it's solely dedicated, whether it's to hekdesh, where it's kedusha the guf of the animal, or whether it's tachriche amet, where they're solely dedicated to the mate, that also can be mafkia the shibud. And so therefore, you have other manifestations of this ability to be makdish. Tosfot brings that example and brings two other examples of items that can be mafkia and starts to wonder why the Gemara didn't bring these examples as well. Tosfot says avodah zarah is another area or vehicle by which you can remove the ownership of a shibud if you make it into avodah zarah and then you make it a surah na'ah that needs to be wiped out. That will also eliminate the shibud over here. The Tosfot says that that's subsumed under hektesh. That's a different form of hektesh. It's a hektesh in a negative form, but it's hektesh towards avodah zarah. But then Tosfot says mecher, a sale can also undermine a shibud because a mecher takes away the shibud of the creditor because the chachamim instituted to protect buyers that if the item is sold with this lien on it, that the lien will disappear so that the buyers won't lose. In order to protect buyers in these situations, then we didn't allow the lien to be enforced. So Tosfot says, why didn't the Gemara bring that as well? Only bringing these three examples, not other examples. So Tosfot gives two answers to that question. One is that these three items are found in Mishnayot, and therefore the Rava's statement was only about items that were found in Mishnayot. The other possibility is that din derabonan is for a different reason. The reason that the shibud breaks over here with these three items is because whatever you did was so powerful that it eliminated the shibud. By the case of mecher, it was an institution of the chachamim to protect buyers because buyers were unaware of the lien and then they're going to go buy things and then they're going to lose out. So in cases where the lien is well known, again, where it's on property or where it's well documented and it's public, then the buyer takes that risk knowing that the lien is there. But in a case where the buyer doesn't know about the lien, then the lien gets wiped out, not because his purchase is so powerful, just that the chachamim instituted protection for buyers. And so it's not on the same level or the same mechanism by which it's freeing the shibud, and that's why Rava doesn't include it in this list. So again, we explained hekdesh. Chametz is a scenario based on the Mishnah and Psachim, which is that if a Jew borrows money from a non-Jew, and he pledges his chametz as collateral, if Pesach comes and the chametz is still in the house of the Jew, even though the goy has a shibud, has a lien on it, the isur chametz of Pesach comes, wipes out the lien of the goy, and makes it asur ba'na'ah, and after Pesach, that chametz is asur, like chametz shavar lava Pesach. Again, the chametz, the isur chametz, overcomes the lien of the goy. That is because of what it's called mechusar guvaina. It lacks the ability to be collected. Had it been in the possession of the goy, had the goy already had it in his house, had he had a lien on it and it was in his house, then the chametz would not be considered chametz shavalava Pesach because it already was collected. It's as if he has it already. The same thing with the hekdesh. You can't be makdish something if the collateral is being held by the creditor himself. And shichrur, the freeing of a slave, is also a mechanism that overcomes or overpowers the shibud because the shibud was on the slave. But the owners have a right to free the slave. And if they free the slave, then that shibud goes away because the lien only existed because of the fact that the owner had monetary rights in the slave. Once those monetary rights are abrogated, then there's no lien left to be had over here. So what the Gemara is suggesting over here is that's the machloket here is about Rava's position, which is Rava says that shichrur can overcome a lien. And that's what happens here. The woman who knocked out the tooth or the eye of the eved in essence, the Eved should be granted freedom over here. Midoraita min haTorah, the Eved should go free. What's preventing him from going free is the fact that the husband has a lien, because the husband's rights were placed here by Beit Din and Usha when they were mitakein that the husband has rights. That means a lien is blocking the shichrur. So what the Gemara is suggesting over here is that Rava's din would remove that shibut. The Eved goes free. And it's interesting here. It's not just when the Balim free it. Here it's even when the Eved goes free against the will of the owner, because they knocked out a tooth or eye. Nevertheless, that's still strong enough to overcome the lien and wipe out the lien of the husband. The other Braita believes that that's not the case, or doesn't hold of the dinim of Rava. And now the Gemara says about that, Lema de Rava Tanayi. That means that Rava's din is a machloket Tanaim. We don't want that, because we want to be able to paskin like these dinim of Rava. If we make it to machloket Tanaim, it's not as muskam lako. Where it says, lo, the kuliyama itluhu de Rava, everybody holds of Rava. V'achal mu'a rabbanon the shibuda de Baal. Over here, they strengthened the shibud of the Baal. We saw this in a number of places in Ketubot and in Gittin, which is that sometimes when there's a shibud, there's a lien, that lien can be broken by hekdesh, chametz, shichur. The other items are konamot. Certain types of nidarim can override them. The Gemara told us in a number of places that the chachamim strengthened the lien to supersede these items and not allow them to abrogate the lien. And that's what the Gemara's argument, the Breitot are arguing about over here. Everybody thinks that Rav is right, that the woman's freeing of the slave should eliminate the husband's lien that he gained through Takanat Usha. The question is, how strong is the shibud of the Baal? Is the shibud of the Baal just a regular shibud? And therefore the woman's shichrur, unintentional shichrur, because she knocked out the tooth of the eye of the Eved, still, that will override the shibud of the Baal and the Eved will go free. Or do we say that when the Chachamim granted the husband rights of shibud here, they granted him super rights of shibud, and those super rights of shibud then will supersede the shichrur being something that can eliminate the shibud. And so that's the machloki between the Tanaim. So they both hold a Rava, just a question of Takanat Usha. How powerful is Takanat Usha? Is it just a regular lien? Or is it a super lien, which in that case, the shichrur would not overcome? All right, we're going to stop here 4 lines down on the top of Tzadi Yamad Aleph, and tomorrow we'll continue with an Ibaidema, but the reason why we won't do it today is because that Ibaidema leads into that Machloket of Eish Lakish and Rabbi Yochanan about whether Kinyan Peirot is Kinyan Aguf Domi.